Liegen over een mondkapjesdeal die je hebt gesloten met de overheid. Een deal waarmee je miljoenen hebt verdiend. Dat doet toch alleen Siewert van Liende? Nou, nee. Ik ben Felicia Alberding en in de Mondkapjesmiljonairs duik ik met een team van correspondenten in andere schandalen. Want wist je dat Siewert helemaal niet uniek is? Luister de Mondkapjesmiljonairs in je Podimo-app. Of ga naar podimo.nl/mondkapjes. En probeer Podimo 30 dagen. Podimo.nl/mondkapjes.
Hoi luisteraar, wij zijn Hugo, Max en Leon van de Grote Podcastlas. Wij zijn drie geografen en elke week behandelen wij een ander land.
We spreken onder andere de geschiedenis, politiek, natuur, maar ook de sport, de muziek en natuurlijk het eten.
De nijlpaarden van Pablo Escobar, de vele bunkers van Albanië en het verschil tussen een sheik en een emir zijn zomaar wat voorbeelden die langskomen.
Maar we bespreken ook de geopolitieke invloed van China in Afrika en de impact van het Europese kolonialisme.
Luister dus wekelijks naar de audioversie van de Atlas, de grote podcastlas.
These national or nationalistic right-wing parties, they have a very clear vision, and it's actually a good vision in a sense that it's understandable. Yeah, it's bad because it's, from my perspective, sorry for the wording, but bullshit. Like, it doesn't make any sense to close back the borders and think that you can barter out deals with your neighboring countries. But at least it's clear. And if you then ask the, you know, other normal parties, what is your vision for the future of Europe? They don't have an answer.
Dit is Betrouwbare Bronnen met Jaap Janssen.
Hallo, welkom in Betrouwbare Bronnen aflevering 189. En welkom ook PG.
Dag Jaap.
PG, we hebben twee zeer interessante gasten die elkaar goed kennen, maar nog nooit samen in één podcast bij elkaar zaten. En ook niet op radio of televisie trouwens. Maar eerst wil ik graag een aantal nieuwe vrienden van de show verwelkomen. Luisteraars die met een donatie Betrouwbare Bronnen mede mogelijk maken. De nieuwe vrienden zijn Jan Willem, Jarno, Utsas, Anne, David, Paul, Vincent, Margreet en PHM. Wil jij ons ook helpen met een donatie? Ga dan naar vriendvandeshow.nl/bb. En op die site verschijnen ook regelmatig berichten over Betrouwbare Bronnen. Vriendvandeshow.nl/bb.
Heel erg bedankt. Het is gewoon fijn dat we zoveel waardering bij deze mensen vinden.
Dit is Betrouwbare Bronnen.
PG, zondag is het 9 mei, de Dag van Europa. Dat is sinds 1985 een jaarlijkse dag om mensen bewust te maken van het belang van Europese samenwerking. Waarom is dat speciaal op 9 mei?
Het is zondag 9 mei, precies 71 jaar geleden, dat Robert Schuman, de Franse minister van Buitenlandse Zaken, een toespraak hield. En die toespraak, dat is eigenlijk de basis geworden van, zeg maar, de samenwerking van de Europese regeringen. En dat begon met kolen en staal. De basis van oorlog, geweld, industrie en een hoop narigheid, maar ook van een hoop welvaart, zeker in die tijd nog.
De Europese gemeenschap van kolen en staal.
En dat idee van Jean Monnet, we hadden vorig jaar precies om deze tijd, daarom ook zijn portret in Betrouwbare Bronnen, is door Schuman als het ware toen op tafel gelegd. Grappig genoeg omdat hij een paar dagen daarna naar Londen ging om met de Britse regering daarover te praten. Vanuit het idee, als wij Fransen nou met de Duitsers dat samen doen, dan gaan die andere landen in Europa onmiddellijk zeggen, dat willen wij ook, dat kunnen we samen doen. Want dan heb je en welvaart en vrede als daar in één hand als idee. En ja, die datum van die speech van Schuman is als daar de dag geworden die men elk jaar, ja, een beetje viert. Natuurlijk ook omdat 8 mei de dag was van de capitulatie van de nazi-legers.
En omdat het Europadag is, verwelkomen we in deze aflevering twee super-Europese gasten. Laurens Dassen, op 17 maart gekozen in de Tweede Kamer als lid van de nieuwe partij Volt. En Damian Beuzelager, in 2019 gekozen in het Europees Parlement als eerste en enige Volt-afgevaardigde in Straatsburg en Brussel. Laurens is bij ons in Amsterdam en Damian is in... Waar is Damian?
In Berlijn.
Oh, in Berlin. Herzlich willkommen, Damian Beuzelager.
Danke sehr.
Damian and Lawrence, let's talk the lingua franca of the European Union. Let's talk in English, if you don't mind. Damian, you are one of three young people who founded Volt. What is the basic idea behind Volt?
To understand the basic idea, I think it's helpful to understand a bit the history. Yeah? So I never intended to go into politics, and I just started a master in public administration, and I thought I would just study and then go back to my private sector career. But that was, I think, when I started this master, was in 2016, in September. So this is just after the Brexit referendum. And it's also in the time when, you know, Marine Le Pen was running a really strong campaign, when the AfD was just founded and getting stronger and stronger, and also when Trump was elected. So it was quite a political time. And I would just remember that basically with the other two, Andrea Venzon from Italy and Colombe Cansavador from France, who I got to know during my studies, we were discussing a lot, I think like many of us, no, in this time. And so we thought, actually, if we look at the world right now, we believe that, especially in Europe, we need to cooperate more closely to tackle the big challenges of our time, yeah? Be it climate change, be it migration, be it, you know, even digitization. You know, if you want to have an AI startup work, it needs to also work across borders. So all of this meant that we need to get closer together. But the whole political message at the time was very strong to, you know, go back to national borders, to close the borders, to deal with our problems from a national perspective. And so we thought, yeah, to do something about it, maybe we need to get politically active. And since we then realized that there's no real European party, we just came up with this idea and then started.
But there are already political families in Europe, like the Christian Democrats, the Social Democrats, the Liberals. And the Greens, they also pretend to be a European political party.
But it's absolutely clear that the power of these parties lies in the national capitals, yeah? So, I mean, it's clear that, you know, for the CDU, CSU, the power lies within Germany. And yes, they are part of the European People's Party. But in the end, for all important decisions, it will be the national party leaders who call the shots. It's not Manfred Weber, yeah? So, and I think this is something important to understand. The party manifesto, the power of decision making, all of this lies currently in the capitals, even when it comes to European political parties.
But that is, of course, essential for Europe, that philosophy, that it is the nations, the national governments who work together and have a European common destiny and a common sort of also political family as Europe. And that so the political philosophies in Europe also have these political families. In that sense, the fact that these political families are constituted from national tradition and national convictions is a plus and not a minus, I think.
So I would have to fully disagree. And just because we already take a lot of decisions on the European level. Yeah? And I think that's okay. We decided that when it comes to trade, for example, when it comes to some interior market issues, we
but
want...
The word we is the national governments, is not the European Parliament or the European bureaucrats.
No, it's the Europeans, I think, thought that it makes sense to decide certain things on the European level. And I'm just, the only thing that we realize right now is that the decision-making processes that we have are not perfect. And that it doesn't feel super democratic if you have national governments who are in the end still bartering out deals as if we were in medieval times. And that's the issue. I'm not saying we should decide more on the European level. I'm just saying, like, the way we take decisions right now is always out of a national interest, which blocks the interest of the European Union as a whole. And that's the issue we need to tackle right now.
And that's also something what I found very interesting also looking at when I read about Volt, I thought about, okay, this idea of a European party where you unite across borders people with an idea seems so logical that it's strange that it's not already there.
But it's a supranational party, more than a European party.
It's really a European party. And if you look at European problems only from a national interest, then you do not look at the best solutions. You look at the best solutions for a very small proportion of the Europeans. And if you really want to change climate, or if you really want to ensure that the migration is done in a humane manner, or if you want to fight social inequality, then you also need to ensure that you do that in the same direction in all different countries and on the European level.
But does that supplant national politics and national political conventions and convictions?
I believe it strongly that it should enable the different levels on the local, on the national, and on the European level. And I find it very interesting that we already discussed.
Which is, European, of course, what, for instance, the EPP or the Social Democrats do.
No, but the interesting, because you mentioned the Social Democrats, and if you look at, for example, the subject of migration, and there we say, okay, in the Netherlands you have the PvdA, which is for a humane migration policy. Then you have the same Social Democrats in Denmark who have a totally different view on migration. The same accounts for, if you look at the Renew Group, there you have the VVD and D66, which are both Dutch parties, which I believe have a total different view on how the way Europe should act.
But isn't it already?
That diversity, isn't that the strength of Europe? Which everybody always says.
And isn't that diversity also the fact in a national party between... Well, the Frisian guy in parliament.
The Bavarians and the Hamburgers.
The Limburgian.
Yeah. But maybe we can go to Germany as an example. Yeah, we already have a federal party democracy. No, we have a local, for example, Green Party. We have a regional one and we have a national Green Party. And the only thing we are saying is, since we already have a European democracy, let's also have a European Green Party. That's all we're saying. And I think sometimes people make it more complex than it actually is. Yeah. The only thing we're trying to say is we want one European party with the same program, with the same content, with the same name, so that people know what they're voting for. But this is only the first step, because the second step, and we haven't talked about this yet, is equally important. You need to change the European Union to become a parliamentary democracy. What does it mean? It means that if you vote, for example, for the S&D or for the EPP, so for the Social Democrats or the Conservatives, you would see an actual shift in politics in the European Union. And currently, this is not the case, yeah? Because currently you can vote for whomever you like. The actual government will be chosen by the national level, irrespective of whatever the outcome of these votes are. And these are, so our idea of building a European party is only the first step, so that at some point European citizens are enabled to actually change the course of European decision making with their vote, and that we have a parliamentary democracy. And I do believe it's really needed, yeah? Because currently there's a perceived lack of lack of influence for citizens. And I think we should really give that back, this power back to all of us.
Well, there is, of course, one really attractive, and I must say also convincing idea within the Volt idea. And that is that as a Dutchman, I am not able to vote for Angela Merkel. And as a Dutchman, I am not able to vote for Macron or for... Salvini, which even some Dutchmen might do. And that, of course, and the same thing, of course, is that a German cannot vote for Sigrid Kaag in the Netherlands. And that idea that you have these common European party lists with also common European candidates is a very attractive idea.
I think it's also true that already, Merkel is taking decisions which affect all Europeans. Yeah. For example, in 2012, I was traveling to Greece. And a person came to me and said, why is Merkel cutting my wage in half? And he was right, because there was a certain influence of Merkel on the austerity policy, which then affected the Greek government's choice on, the wages that were there. And I'm not saying that austerity was the wrong or the right thing to do, but it's true that the citizen there didn't have any voting power to kick Merkel out of office, to change to be, for example, a more expansionist kind of fiscal policy. So I think if these decisions aren't taken and they affect all citizens, we also need to give citizens the power to change the cause or to support the cause. Yeah? And this currently doesn't take place so much.
Can you give us a few examples what you missed in policies before you founded Volt?
As I said, our approach came a bit out of the idea that we saw all this right-wing populism rising. And the first thing that we realized is while, as I said earlier, these national or nationalistic right-wing parties, they have a very clear vision. And it's actually a good vision in a sense that it's understandable. Yeah, it's bad because it's, from my perspective, sorry for the wording, but it's bullshit. It doesn't make any sense to close back the borders and think that you can barter out deals with your neighboring countries. But at least it's clear. And if you then ask the, other normal parties, what is your vision for the future of Europe? They don't have an answer. They say, yeah, we want to meddle through, basically. Yeah, they say, yeah, let's keep it like it is. But as it is right now, doesn't work. And that's what, Brexit showed us. If we continue with this in-between kind of version, we don't really have a solution. So if you ask me for the first difference that Volt has from a political perspective, it is to have an absolute clear vision of what Europe should look like in 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, 50 years. And then based on that vision, you know, we can talk about all content topics, yeah, be it migration, be it digitization, as I said earlier. But this is the core and fundamental that we want.
We are going to talk about this, but first introducing you. When you decided to participate in the European elections, your goal was to get at least 25 seats in the European Parliament. You only won one seat in that big parliament of 705 seats. Was this a deception for you?
It was a huge success, to be honest. I mean, without ambition, nothing happens. But you have to see the realistic achievement that we made. Yeah, we started 2 years before the parliamentary elections, and we managed to build chapters in 15 national countries, basically. And we ran for the parliamentary elections out of 7 countries. For me, that was a huge success. And that brings me also to the second big element of why we founded Volt, is to bring people back to politics, especially from the middle and not so extreme, yeah, from those who want to have a positive vision for politics, those who want to just, you know, work for a betterment of society. And so for me, to be honest, like the fact that we ran out of 7 countries after 2 years is a huge success. And then we won this one seat. It was just so cool. And I remember, you know, this feeling of joy for all of these volunteers that helped. So I'm honestly very happy. Obviously, it could always be better, but for me, it's a marathon. Volt is a marathon. If you want to build a European party, this is not done overnight.
So you won one seat in those 7 countries, and that country was in Germany. So you won a national seat in a national election within the European election. Now, do you have an idea who voted for you? Because that, of course, after the recent Dutch parliamentary election, everybody's interested in who are these people who voted for Volt? What is sort of the demographic? What is the, let's say, where in Germany did you get your votes? Areas of Bavaria or in Berlin?
But before we go to that question, I think it's because you mentioned you got one seat from Germany. In the end, and that's why I think it was also a success, we ran in all those different countries with exactly the same program. And we got more than 600,000 votes in all those different countries. I believe in the Netherlands, we had 2% of the total votes, and we only existed for 10 months. In Luxembourg, we got also, I believe, 2.3% of the votes. And indeed, in Germany, we had enough votes for one seat. But looking at 600,000 votes from all Europeans, that is quite a lot.
It's an excellent result if exactly. You just started.
And the nice thing, and that's why for me that was also a success, is even though I voted Volt in the Netherlands and we didn't get a seat in the Netherlands, I still have a representative in the European Parliament, be it Damian, because he run on the same program as that we run. And then we can go through to the question, because that's another interesting thing, that during the European elections, all the countries, so all the European citizens, have different democratic barriers. So, for example, in the Netherlands, you set up a vereniging and you hand in a list, you pay 12,000 euros and you can participate in the elections. In Italy, for example, you need to have 150,000 signatures to even run in the elections.
Yeah, and in France, you didn't have enough money to...
And in France, but Damian, maybe you can help me with this, but I believe in France, you need to print out your own voting ballots and distribute them throughout the country. And to get enough votes for seats, I believe you already need to spend 1 million euros.
So now we understand why Putin loaned money to Marine Le Pen.
This is actually an old practice. I think what you realize is, you know, coming from the private sector, barriers to entry are always introduced to somehow, you know, safeguard the people who are already there. Yeah, and I mean, it is absolutely ridiculous that you have these laws sometimes preventing you from even registering a party as a party, sometimes, as Lauren said, for registering for the European elections, and sometimes being like these really dumb things that the state doesn't print your ballot paper, that you have to print it yourself. I mean, the cost for that, we estimated, would have been 800,000 euros to be printing our own ballot paper and sending it to all the electoral offices across France to be able to be elected. Yeah, while the state does that for the bigger parties. So there's definitely like always these hurdles. And now in the European Parliament, I work on the European electoral law reform, and I'll try to ensure that this is not happening like this anymore.
But now the answer to the question of PG, who are voting for
vote. Who voted for what. So, I mean, to be honest, since we are so small, there's not a lot of analysis back from the European Parliament elections. I guess Lawrence has much clearer insight for who voted for in the Dutch elections. But I can tell you that who we targeted, who was, you know, different groups of people who just want to see progressive and positive politics. So a lot of young voters, there was definitely a group that we thought could, you know, where our message could resonate since we're also quite young. And but also, funnily, like the rather old generation that still has the understanding that war is not something abstract, but something that can happen if you don't constantly improve your democracy and if you don't participate in democracy. So there was also that group. And to be honest, in between, we have people from all the different political parties who just like our pragmatic and a bit more fact-based approach and not so much ideological approach. So yeah, there's a range of different people. But I don't know, Lawrence, maybe you have a clearer image also from the last elections.
Yeah, so getting back to the first time I encountered with Volt was in an article of Caroline de Gruyter, which stated new energy for Europe. And for me also the words new energy and reading about a young group of people, be it Damian and Andrea and Colomb, who had this new idea of ensuring that we solve the big challenges of today. And I think that idea resonates with a lot of young people as well, because they grow up with the euro. They don't have never had the gulden. They grow up without borders. They see that climate change is one of their biggest challenges, and they understand that that needs to be solved together. And then of course, you have the Erasmus beurs, where a lot of young people are also able to study abroad.
So it's a party also for anywheres.
Well, I think that's too easy, because there is indeed a lot of young people who, have the idea of working together across borders. But like Damia mentioned, and that's also something you see in the Netherlands, there's also a group of older people that grew up with the European project, that see that the world is moving to a more story of national borders again, national parties focus, and that say, okay, we are worried about this and we want to ensure that we move in another direction, and that also a young generation is able to speak out for their own future. And that's also what I think is very important, that we as Volt contribute also to the political landscape, is that we are also able to force other political parties to address where their vision for Europe is. And that it's not just, okay, everything is good as it is right now, and that we only hear the other side of the story, that we want to move back to national borders. But where's the vision for Europe? And that's our vision, is a European parliamentary democracy.
But then, Damian, as one person in that very big parliament, 705 seats, you cannot do pretty much, I suppose.
I do believe I can, and I can give you some examples in a second. But just to go back to one little point that Lawrence just said, I think sometimes since we wake up, you know, and grow up in a certain time in history, we forget that things constantly change. Yeah? I mean, for example, you know, I was born 88. So when I was very, very small, Germany reunited. But this was a huge change of our socio-political structure, if you like. And these changes, if you look 30 years back further and 30 years back further, obviously you see are quite big. And to understand that, you know, things change and that we have to somehow, you know, be on top of this change and make it a positive change rather than a negative is something that we sometimes forget. You know, we think that things will just continue as they are, but they won't. And for us, this new energy for Europe is just saying, let's make it a positive change. Yeah, just to underline that one more time.
Yeah, and maybe because we started the show with also the Schuman Declaration. I looked it up also, what he said, because that is, I think, very inspiring, where he said world peace cannot be safeguarded without making of creative efforts proportionate to the dangers which threaten it. And I think you also constantly, as society, needs to ensure that you keep on safeguarding and making these efforts in going forward. And that sometimes you also need to change the status quo to ensure that these efforts are being made.
Schuman in 1950, of course, had this experience. He was not a young man then, of a completely destroyed and also new Europe from 45 to 50. And was also more or less like we and like Germany in 1989, 1990, when you were just born, Damian, in this incredible change and also almost revolutionary situations. And then, of course, the question is, how do you keep things going? And exactly as Damian said, it is not a business as usual. Things go as they go. Sometimes you have these very deep moments in which politics, you know, is sort of redefined. And this is, of course, why Schuman's declaration was sort of a tryout of this kind of redefinition.
I think, to be honest, change is constant, as you just said. And I think that also Corona covered a bit of the actual debates that we had, whether we want to be a closed society or more open to society. And this will come back. Yeah, I think currently a lot of the existing parties still got some support in many member states because people want to at least safeguard some political stability. But this will not necessarily be maintained. And so the question is, you know, can we re-engage into this, like, to be democracies? Can we re-engage citizens to be part of democracies? I mean, just to give you one number, since the 1980s, party membership in Europe has halved. Yeah? So people are not becoming part of political parties anymore because they think, you know, this is not for me, this is not sexy, who wants to be a politician? But that's an issue. And it is a change that is negative. And so for us to bring this new energy also means somehow re-engaging people into politics, yeah? Just to put this.
Oh, indeed, and a lot of people within Volt have never been part of a political party before, especially also young people, but also elderly people. And I find that indeed very inspiring that a lot of people are, well, showing that they, on a voluntarily basis, spend their free time in ensuring that, well, we go one step further. But also maybe to get back to the question, if one seat is a success, and we experienced it as well in the Netherlands that Damian got elected, the difference between zero and one was such a big moment for us as a Volt organization.
It's 100% different.
Exactly, but it inspired a lot of people to continue working on Volt.
And can I change things? I think my facet right now is yes. Yeah. I mean, I was obviously equally, you know, excited about this and not sure whether it would be possible because I'm new to politics and I didn't know whether one person can do a lot. But now looking back, I mean, I spent more of my time already as a remote parliamentarian than actually in person. But I think I was able to do a lot. And that is because I joined a political group so that I would actually be able to work on legislation. And
yeah, in a way, you had to do an old-fashioned thing, join an already existing political group. And you made a choice between the Liberals and the Greens, and you decided to go to the Green group. Why did you make that decision?
So we gave this vote to all of our movement across Europe, yeah? Because we thought it's such an important decision. Let's ask all our members across the continent what they think. And in the end, they chose the Greens, and I'm quite certain it's because, first of all, under the Renew, so the Liberals, I would have been part of a national delegation, whereas the Greens offered me to be my own delegation. And obviously, if you now know and hear about Volt, for me to be part of the German delegation under the FDP, the German Liberals, was completely contrarian to my actual idea of being a representative for Laurens and everyone who voted across the continent for Volt. So this was a very important point. And the second one was very clearly the committees I was offered. Yeah? So if you you know, think back, our proposal was to do three things in the European elections. One is EU reform, to actually make it in a parliamentary democracy. Second was to get to a more just society. So for me, that would mean working on migration and asylum. And a third, to fight for a more innovative and sustainable economy. And so I wanted to work in the Industrial Policy Committee. So the three committees that I needed for that, the Greens offered. And so I think that was also why the members chose for me to sit with the Greens in that context. Yeah.
Yes, but your aim is still to form a complete Volt group in the future.
Absolutely.
Yeah, definitely. So that's the goal for 2024. Had to really make sure that we have our own European group. And I think also the reason, Damian, because you explained it to me as well back in 2019, is that being part of a group is also necessary in order to be able to be part of committees, to do your work in a proper way.
But of course, we are building vaults further. We have now elected officials as well in Bulgaria, in Germany, and in the Netherlands on the national level now, and also in Italy. And of course, we are still building the movement going further to ensure that 25 seats in 2024.
Yes. Let's talk about your ideas. Damian, you already said that you have a clear idea of what Europe should look like in about 10 or 20 years. Can you tell us a little bit about the most important things you want to realize in Europe in the next 20 years?
Absolutely. I mean, it's super simple. Yeah? I think what we are trying to say is, look, we all know how parliamentary democracy works. Yeah, that's something we learned from the national level, and we're very much aware of it. It's also often very similar even on the local level. And the only thing we're saying is, let's make this work also on the European level, so that when you as a citizen care, for example, let's take the example of less bureaucracy on the European level, you go to the parliamentary elections, you vote for some parliamentarian who says, I want less bureaucracy. And if this parliamentarian becomes part of a majority, then they will field the government. Yeah? And then this government will enact your voters' wish of having less bureaucracy, because that's basically why you voted for them. And if somehow this government fails or does something bad, then parliament can actually kick them out of government and say, sorry, you didn't do it well. We want to field a new government. Maybe a new coalition can come forward. And that's all. Yeah? Basically, to translate it now into these more institutional terms, you want to have a parliament that is voted directly by the citizens. The majority of this parliament can actually field the European executive, so the European Commission. You can call it commission if you like. And then you have a second chamber. You can call it the European Council if you like, which just has one role, which is to ensure that all the rights of the lower levels are not touched upon by the European level, so that basically all the national competence are not infringed by the European. So it's really a simple system, but it would ensure that we as voters, as Europeans, can direct the European policymaking in either a more social, a more austerity, or a less open or more open kind of way, which currently we don't have the power to do.
So you want a European government? Many people fear a European superpower.
We already have a European government. We already take decisions on the European level. It's just a question of how we take the decisions. Yeah. What happened is we somehow thought, okay, let's build a European Parliament and a European Commission, and establish this quasi European government. But we built in, because we were afraid, we built in like a veto power for the national governments against each other for all core questions. Yeah? Sometimes because it's written into the law, and sometimes because it became a bit of a culture of not overgoing a single member state.
And that's also the reason why those European summits sometimes take 3 or 4 days.
It's so inefficient. I mean, I don't know from your experience, yeah, if you ever had a meeting where 27 people can say no, and then something doesn't go forward. I mean, who comes up with such an idea? Again, I come from the private sector. It's absolutely ridiculous. You know, in normal democracy, we know that sometimes we are part of
the private sector is not a democratic way of life.
No, but we
and
also
is not a pluriform, diverse growth process of people.
No, that's true. But if you also look at the Netherlands, we sometimes give that example. I mean, the Netherlands wouldn't be very effective and very going forward if all 12 provinces would have a veto.
We had that for centuries in our republic.
Yeah, and I think it's now more efficient, well organized. And I think that's also where we want to move forward, of course, with Europe and the European Union, because in the end, it's also it's a means to an end. I mean, it's also a way of ensuring that we tackle climate change, that we ensure that we have on a geopolitical side are able to stand up against China or work with the US, and also make sure that we have a more innovative continent, that we invest in the future technologies.
I was surprised when Damian started this whole institutional, sort of constitutional talk, because if I look at the Declaration of Amsterdam...
The Declaration of Amsterdam is the program for the European Parliament.
It's says very clear it wants Europe to become an economic superpower. And so much more, let's say, political content than institutional sort of dreams.
So the thing is, if the current system would be working perfectly, I wouldn't want to change it. Yeah, I'm not, you know, an ideological fighter for a certain type of government. That's not, we, I think also that's true for Laurens. We didn't grow up thinking, you know, the European Union is the coolest thing on earth. We need to fight for it. Yeah, that's not how this came about. I, for myself, I worked in migration before a bit. Yeah. And if you work in this context, you realize that the current system that we have failed. Yeah. And I have to say this very clearly, it failed. In 2015, we had a crisis. The European Commission made a proposal, the so-called Common European Asylum System. The normal process would be that this would go into council and parliament, and then we would find an agreement. But it went into council, and our interior ministers, so Seehofer for me, I don't know exactly who it would be for you, they came together, and it was so toxic that they couldn't talk to each other anymore, which is why until now, we don't have an actual functioning European asylum system, even though everybody knows we need it, and even though everybody knows we need it on the European level, because it doesn't work on the national level if you have open borders. So I don't take the argument that the current system works well. It needs to be changed, and it needs to be changed in a way that it actually is conducive to decision making, that we have actual solutions being proposed. And this, yes, if we don't like them, we can alter them in a democratic process. But to have a stalling and to have this intergovernmentalism, which I think really is archaic, to bring together 27 people, either, you know, ministers of the interior, also heads of state or government, that doesn't work anymore for like controversial topics. It doesn't work when we talk about rule of law, as we can see, because some member states just don't care about it, to be frank. Yeah? It doesn't work when we talk about solidarity on economic levels, because some member states, including maybe the Netherlands, have a hard time understanding that we are one European common market. And it doesn't work if we talk about migration. So, I mean, honestly, I think we need to be a bit better in our decision making. We need to be able to take stronger decisions and, yes, correct them, and also correct them with democratic votes. But we can't believe that the current system is working.
Exactly. And that's also a discussion that is not being held and that is not being debated about, because it's all accepted that we currently function in this way. And if you really want to change it, then also this debate needs to be dealt with. And I think we talked in the Netherlands about the culture in the last few weeks. One of the parts in that is also to ensure that you have trust also from the people in society. And there's a conference on the future of Europe coming up. And I'm very curious of how we ensure that also people, and especially also the people that are not very heard well in their concerns about Europe, are taking along to ensure that we move forward also on an institutional reform.
The idea of the conference on the future of Europe is to get some sprinkling ideas for our future and, well, to put it forward and to...
I think the idea of the conference is... So we talk now about institutions, and I love talking about institutions and institutional reform, but people don't care about that so much. Yeah, they care about topics. They care about migration. They care about climate change. They care about, you know, their startup that they're trying to build and that is not able to hire someone from another member state so easily or something. These are the you know... And what we need to do is we need to talk to citizens about these topics, also foreign policy, and then realize what they actually want, which is a functioning foreign policy, which is an actual answer to climate change. And then we actually, I think, will see that our national parliamentarians and politicians very much have their national focus, where citizens actually care about the topic. And if somebody tells them, look, to be able to tackle climate change, we need to think European, they will say, yes, makes sense. So what do we need on the European level to make it work? Yeah? So for me, the conference is really about talking about the topics and then seeing what system could work best to make that work. And I think for me, the outcome will very clearly be that we need European cooperation. And then if we need European cooperation, we need European decision making, which is democratic, which would be a parliamentary democracy.
So we need to repair or to renovate the vehicle and then make it work. That's the idea.
We just need to go the whole way. Yeah, we walked half the way. We now build a system which is part intergovernmental, meaning all the heads of state coming together and bartering out deals, with some people sometimes coming, you know, with a book, with a biography of something, rather than actually listening to the meeting.
Our Prime Minister, Mark Rutte, he took a book about Frédéric Chopin.
Who is a Polish composer and was a French pianist. So it was a very European idea reading that book, of course.
But it was very anti-European to send this message. Yeah.
And it also shows, of course, and with the whole Corona for Recovery and Resilience Fund is looking at also the debate in the Netherlands. It wasn't there. The government was almost asleep. They weren't paying attention. They didn't want to pay any attention of what was happening in Italy. And they also didn't see what Angela Merkel and Macron were looking at and that they were changing and that they were shifting. And in the end, the Dutch government was, well, way behind the bus. And what was the contribution that we had? It was all negative. And in the end, what did we get? I believe that if you then look in a different way of European cooperation, then this whole debate would have been done in a different way. And then European solidarity, which is needed in such times, can be done in a better way to ensure that we all benefit from this.
By the way, there is still no Dutch concept for the recovery and resilience plan. What do you think about that?
Well, two things. First of all, of course, the Dutch are the ones that indicated that everyone should do reforms. And are the only ones that aren't doing reforms at the moment.
And Mario Draghi, on behalf of Italy, has come with an almost revolutionary plan.
Exactly.
Which the Dutch could almost sort of both admire and be jealous of.
And the plan of the Italians, and let's hope they succeed in this, that the reforms are done in a digital way to ensure that the economy is more robust, but also that the taxpayers of the black money market is not so dominant anymore. But indeed, it's inspiring to see that there is a really thought about reforms. And I understand that Merkel and Macron also discussed their plan. And where is the Dutch plan? It's not existent.
Yeah, but even the Dutch informateur, Herman Cenk Willink, concluded that there cannot be a Dutch plan already because we have to make political choices and there is no political board at the moment in the Netherlands?
Well, I mean, the parliament has been elected. So in that sense, there is a democratic house that can make these choices.
I'm currently, I was negotiating the recovery plan from the parliament's perspective within a team of people. And I remember very well that the Dutch and the German in the negotiations said, you know, no money without reforms. Yeah, our German taxpayer money, our Dutch taxpayer money is not going to be transferred to another country without actual reforms. And now it's a bit hypocritical that exactly these countries that said no money without reforms are the ones that failed to put reforms forward. Yeah, I mean, that's true for Germany as well. The plan that we presented, actually also for France, the plans that were presented are very, very weak on reforms. And I think that that's quite a bad message to other countries. So I really hope that the Netherlands will put forward some reforms to not show basically, oh, only the southerners need to do reforms and not ourselves as well.
And this is also a little bit of the energy that is lacking currently. If we want to make Europe also for a sustainable and innovative future, then we also need to ensure that we are able to put forward plans that are proof for the 21st centuries.
Let me be very specific. In the Declaration of Amsterdam, it says in Europe there should be 4% GDP for R&D, innovation, etc. So I think then that devolved people in the different member countries, and looking, of course, at Laurens also, will then say this should be in that reform program.
So indeed, there should be more money spent on R&D. And what we see on the other end is that thanks to, again, the Dutch government, the money spent in the MFK is less on innovation and that the money on the Horizon program is cut. I think it's a very bad signal also to future generations, but also looking in the world that we are in. I mean, China is moving forward in a digital way very fast with artificial intelligence. And we also need to account that this will also have consequences for our way of living. I mean, if we are not able to also set the standards and the norms on technology, then this will also be influences on our way of life. And therefore, I think it's also important that Europe should be innovative as well.
Well, that's a very specific thing. And that's not a very, let's say, institutional thing.
No, exactly. But like Damian mentioned, the institutional reforms are there to ensure that we move forward on the topics that are important for us all and for people. So, I mean, also, if you look at the big corporations, maybe to conclude on the innovative side, if you look at the 15 big tech companies in the world, then none of them are European. That's also because in the 90s, we missed out on the internet revolution now. And currently, it's the artificial intelligence. But also, if you look at taxation of these big tech companies, it's almost non-existent. And this should be done on a European level. And to do this, in the end, we do this because we want to ensure that they contribute, because they make use of the infrastructures that we have, the education that we have, the digitalization that we provide for them, the labor that we provide for them. But in the end, to do this, we need also institutional reforms to make it effective. So it's two things that we want to achieve.
One more point from the Declaration of Amsterdam. You plead for a broader mandate for, let's say, for the European Central Bank, that it should be more than, let's say, where it started with the Maastricht Treaty as a sort of a financial guarantor against inflation in particular. That, of course, has completely disappeared, more or less, as a goal of the central bank. How are you going to develop this idea, and how are you going to sort of institute the development of such a broader mandate? Because that's a very interesting and also very challenging idea.
Maybe Damian, you can help me out on this one. It's also that we want to ensure that the ECB, like also the Fed in the United States, can also steer on unemployment to ensure that we are more effective in encountering unemployment as well. But then, of course, also the parliamentary oversight should be better and improved. And currently you see that...
And nowadays the central bank only talks to the parliament, but the parliament doesn't have a vote on it.
I think it's a bit broader connected to, funnily, actually the recovery fund that we talked earlier. Yeah, because, I mean, what do you need to be able to get out of a crisis, according to economic theory, is like expansion of your fiscal policy, which is, you know, actually spending more on an investment. And that is what we currently tried, for example, in this crisis with the recovery fund. And what I would argue we would need in general, some form of a general tool to be able to invest once there is a crisis, especially since we are a currency union. At least with a majority of member states. Yeah. So this is the first point, and we can discuss a bit, you know, what kind of changes need to happen to have a European fiscal policy. And then the same question applies to, you know, how can we ensure that our European monetary policy works in the right way? And here it's true that currently, you know, the mandate of the ECB basically says you can only, you know, guard the inflation goal. And since inflation didn't go up, they could still do a lot of expansionist monetary policy, and they did. But I think it's important to understand that they actually went quite far within their given mandate. And it was also a bit problematic at some points. I don't know if you remember this, but Draghi was very heavily criticized at some point for being so expansionist in his monetary policy, in the quantitative easing and so on. And so I think it's important to potentially, you know, give this reality that they're already looking at employment, that they're already looking at the downturn of economies, and also anchor that within their mandate. I think that's important.
Yes. To make Europe a real superpower, Europe also needs a defense capacity, you state in your election platform.
There's 17 different, tank... industries currently running in Europe. Yeah? So basically 17 different tank forms are being produced, which is a lot of spending in the military sector. And here you can already see that if we were able to actually unite our European military capacities together, first of all, it would be more credible. The German army, for example, is hardly able to actually operate on a larger scale at this point. And we would save money in military spending, and we could put it into education and in innovation rather than military. So yeah, for sure, we need to think about how we can potentially come together.
Yeah, and at the same time, we are still very much depending, of course, on the United States at the moment, under NATO. And I think the European Union should be an equal partner in this. And also within the Netherlands, we have the discussion that we are not able to defend ourselves, which is a strange thing. And it's not only about the old type of warfare, tanks and ships, but it's also on the digital level, which is, I believe, very important and which is a constant thing that's happening with attacks on the EMA, with attacks on universities, on all research facilities. So that's also something that we need to ensure that we cooperate more on the European level.
And if you don't have a digital union in Europe on that, then let's say a preventing cyber war union is also not very credible.
Whilst you want to abolish the national veto, does that also mean that Den Haag cannot exclude sending Dutch soldiers while Den Haag doesn't want it?
So I think we have to have a debate, you know, how you can employ European army if you have it. It needs to be clearly under some form of democratic oversight. I would say it needs to be under European parliamentary oversight. But I mean, there are discussions to be had in what way maybe national parliaments should be involved in this. I think what's clear and what we see with Frontex right now, just to bring this in a bit, is whatever we choose to do, it needs to be under the highest ethical and clearest standards, because this would have repercussions on all of Europe. And so what we need to ensure is that the highest standards, the highest, if you take all the different national routes together and you add them to each other, that should be the standard that we have. Yeah, like not the lowest, but the highest standard is at least possible. So to ensure that, our values, our European values are somehow represented in it.
And within this, you also always need a good democratic oversight. So this is not something that can be done in the short run, because we do not have a true European parliamentary democracy at the moment.
One of your ideas is also to take over the French seat in the United Nations Security Council. Do you also want to take over the French atom bomb?
So I think it's clear that we need disarmament of nuclear powers. Eh? I mean, that's absolutely, I have to check again our program, but for me, this is absolutely clear that we definitely need proliferation. Sorry, I'm having a hard time with the word right now. But it's absolutely clear for me. So I don't want to take over any nuclear power, like nuclear weapons. Eh?
Dit is Betrouwbare Bronnen, een podcast met betrouwbare bronnen.
Damian, let's talk for a while in Dutch about the experiences of Laurens in the Dutch parliament. Laurens, bijna niemand kende Volt nog in Nederland, maar u blufte meteen al in interviews in de verkiezingscampagne. Ja, we gaan tenminste 3 zetels halen en dat lukte ook nog. Hoe is dat gekomen?
Ja, nou, we hadden het er net natuurlijk al even over, van bij de Europese verkiezingen hebben wij 2% van de stemmen gehaald. En dat was voor ons eigenlijk ook het eikpunt, dat we zeiden, oké, dit hebben we bij de Europese verkiezingen gehaald. Dat is ook iets wat we willen evenaren bij de nationale verkiezingen. En ik vind het mooi dat je zegt van, ja, jullie kwamen in 1 keer uit het niets. Maar dat was voor ons natuurlijk niet zo. Want zoals je ook met Damian net hoorde van, we waren al heel lange tijd bezig om Volt op te bouwen. En ook in Nederland zijn we vanaf 2018 zijn we bezig geweest om een beweging op te bouwen. Uiteindelijk hier naartoe. En we hebben daarin hele sterke lokale teams neergezet. Die ons geholpen hebben aan het begin van januari om alle handtekeningen op te halen. Maar daarin zag je ook in 1 keer dat die energie loskwam bij de campagne. En dus dat we ook steeds meer werden opgepikt bij de media. Nou, en energie en het verhaal van Europese samenwerking en dat we echt met elkaar daar stappen in moeten gaan zetten, dat resoneert bij heel veel mensen, zowel jong als oud. Dus voor ons was het iets waar we jaren mee bezig waren geweest, waarvan we zeiden van, we geloven hier zo ontzettend in. En we zijn blij dat verhaal natuurlijk ontzettend aanslaat.
Sinds u gekozen bent op 17 maart zijn er nog geen...
ik weet niet of dat... Of dat standaard is in de podcast.
Maar... Ja, dat is eigenlijk wel. Eigenlijk
oké, dan je mag het ook houden.
Nee, wij zijn graag heel beleefd.
Ja.
Maar goed, we spraken ook in de voornamen tot nu toe. Sinds je gekozen bent op 17 maart zijn er een paar debatten geweest. Maar dat waren eigenlijk geen inhoudelijke debatten. Dus we zijn heel benieuwd naar wat Volt in het Nederlandse parlement ook gaat doen. Aansluitend op wat we net bespraken over al die Europese visies die jullie hebben. Heb ik even nagelezen in de gespreksverslagen van Herman Cenk Willink met u en ook uw brief erbij genomen die u aan de informateur heeft geschreven. Daar zagen we die typische Europese punten nog niet echt terug. Maar als je het nou hebt over een nieuwe bestuurscultuur die nodig is aan het Binnenhof, zou je dan ook niet, dat is dan natuurlijk de relatie tussen de regering en het parlement, maar zou je ook niet moeten praten over de relatie van Nederland met Europa? En dan lijkt het me juist voor u ook iets om dat te agenderen.
Nou, sterker nog, we hadden dat punt net, Damian, ook aan de orde.
Precies, ik heb het al even genoemd. Van, het is echt, we hebben het in Nederland hebben we het erover, maar het is natuurlijk iets wat eigenlijk Europees ook heel erg speelt. En die discussie zou veel breder gevoerd moeten worden. En ik denk ook niet dat de bestuurscultuur alleen maar in het parlement is. Ik denk ook dat het dat mee te maken heeft van het vertrouwen wat mensen hebben in de politiek. En dat is in Nederland, maar dat geldt natuurlijk voor heel Europa. En daarbij moeten we ook echt wel in acht nemen dat, als je kijkt naar het toeslagenschandaal, van wat daar gebeurd is en hoe daar dus ook de rechtsstaat is geschonden. Dat wordt ook in Europa weer gebruikt door andere landen van, ja, Nederland, allemaal leuk en aardig dat jullie ons aanspreken, maar kijk eens wat je zelf doet. Dus dat heeft ook directe gevolgen. En ja, dat moet wel beseft worden, ook in het Nederlands parlement en ook door de Nederlandse regering.
Waarom stond dat punt van Nederland moet een misschien wat opener, actievere relatie ook richting Europa hebben? Dus niet in die punten van de nieuwe bestuurscultuur die u bij Cenk Willink hebt neergelegd. Want dat viel mij ook wel op, ja. Ja, dat er niet in stond.
We hebben het zeker ook besproken. En ik ben ook blij dat het ook in het rapport van Cenk Willink staat. En komende week hebben we natuurlijk het debat hierover. En dan kan ik u garanderen dat daar absoluut terug gaat komen.
Ja, juist zijn misschien wel zaken voor u te doen. Ik blijf toch maar u praten, want dan ben ik nou eenmaal al 189 afleveringen zo gewend. Als je kijkt wat een aantal partijen die waarschijnlijk straks ook verder gaan praten over de inhoudelijke vormgeving van een nieuw regeerakkoord, even los van de vraag wie uiteindelijk in de coalitie stappen, dan zie je dat met name D66, het CDA, de Partij van de Arbeid, GroenLinks en ook uw partij Volt bij Cenk Willink hebben gepleit voor een actief Europa-beleid. Dus het zou best wel eens kunnen dat Nederland een kabinet krijgt met een regeerakkoord, wat in jaren niet zo pro-Europa is geweest.
Nou, ik denk dat dat ontzettend goed zou zijn als dan daarin ook het besef zit dat naast natuurlijk die grote uitdaging die we Europees echt aan moeten pakken, dat we dus ook als Nederland veel meer een voortrekkersrol weer gaan nemen in hoe kan die Europese samenwerking eruit zien. En dus dat de minister-president niet met een boek van Chopin naar de Europese Raad gaat, maar met een daadwerkelijk idee wat hij gaat pitchen bij zijn ambtsgenoten, om te zorgen dat we dus beter met elkaar gaan samenwerken. En dat ook het debat in Nederland daar veel meer open gegooid wordt. Ja, ik denk dat dat er ook uiteindelijk toe gaat leiden dat in het parlement ook veel meer creatieve ideeën naar voren komen. En dus dat het ook weer echt om die ideeën gaat in dat Europese debat.
Ja, u heeft zelf al wel gezegd, wij gaan als Volt niet meeregeren.
Nou, we hebben in ieder geval aangegeven van dat het op dit moment absoluut niet bij ons ligt om daar het voortouw in te nemen. En
dat zegt het CDA ook.
Kijk, wij willen graag in het Nederlands parlement zorgen dat echt dat Europa-debat wordt aangewakkerd. En daar gaan we ook hard mee aan de slag. Juist ook om te zorgen, en dat ik ben blij dat dat net ook even aan de orde kwam, om te zorgen dat de grote vraagstukken van vandaag, klimaat, migratie, veiligheid, digitalisering, sociale ongelijkheid, echt worden aangepakt. En dat er op een Europese blik ook naar wordt gekeken.
Ja, u heeft al één aangenomen motie op uw naam staan. Een motie over de informatieplicht van de regering aan het parlement. Wat wil die motie?
Nou, dus dat we in het debat kwam heel erg naar voren dat er onduidelijkheid is eigenlijk over de inlichtingplicht van het kabinet aan de Kamer. En ik geloof dat in de jaren 80 is die discussie ook al geweest natuurlijk. In 2002 heeft minister De Vries heeft daar een invulling aan gegeven. Dat is in 2016 door Plasterk volgens mij bestendigd. En eigenlijk is daarna, door Raymond Knops, is daar toch een andere invulling aan gegeven.
Ja, minister Klaas De Vries, die destijds dus een uitleg heeft gegeven hoe je de grondwet, dat artikel 68, moet interpreteren. Die zei onlangs op de radio, ik heb helemaal niks veranderd of aangescherpt. Ik heb gewoon echt puur uitgelegd wat daar staat in dat artikel. En als je dat gewoon op die manier uitvoert, dan is er niks aan de hand, zegt hij.
Nou, maar het is dus op een andere manier geïnterpreteerd. Want nu zijn de beleidsopvattingen, et cetera, zijn allemaal niet meegenomen.
Het staatsrecht groeit met de dag, dat weten we.
Ja, Nou, en dus hierin, hè, en dat beoogt de motie ook, is omdat daar zoveel onduidelijkheid over is, is om te zorgen, en daarom staat er ook over een brede commissie. Hè, dus dat is niet alleen maar de Kamer, maar dat is juist dus ook met alle grondwetgevende organen. Dus dat je daar die discussie mee aangaat. Om te zorgen dat dat echt duidelijk wordt.
Ja, ik vond die motie, ik heb hem hier voor mij liggen, om twee redenen heel interessant. De eerste reden is dat de motie hiermee dus vastlegt, want ik begreep dat die met ongeveer algemene stemmen is aangenomen of iets dergelijks, dat het dus de Tweede Kamer is die als daar zegt, dit is wat wij met de grondwet willen. De Tweede Kamer interpreteert wat moet zeggen wat de grondwet wil.
Kijk, uiteindelijk is de grondwet is natuurlijk ook iets wat, wat wij belangrijk vinden en ja, wat ons bindt, wat ons ook inspireert, waarop eigenlijk een beetje de centrale rol eigenlijk ook heeft in ons hele beleidsvormingsproces. Ja, dan moet de Kamer moet daar natuurlijk ook een actievere rol in spelen in hoe daarmee omgegaan wordt en hoe dat goed te interpreteren. Maar niet alleen de Kamer zou dat moeten doen.
Nee, wat u zegt in de constateringen van de motie van ja, voorstellen tot interpretatie van de informatieplicht waar dat grondwetsartikel over gaat, zijn uitsluitend van het kabinet gekomen. Dat is natuurlijk inderdaad een hele opvallende constatering.
Ja.
Dat de Tweede Kamer dus al die jaren heeft gezegd, nou, we horen het wel van de ministers wat zij vinden.
Ja. Vandaar dat ja, juist die brede commissie, dat daar veel actiever mee aan de slag gegaan moet worden.
En het tweede, want dat vond ik ook dus heel interessant, ja, dat u zei, kom nou met een commissie. Ik dacht lezend van, dat is interessant om een commissie van bijvoorbeeld Eerste en Tweede Kamer samen te hebben, die als het ware naar die staatsrechtelijke kant kijkt. Ik hoor nu van u dat u zegt, ik kijk eigenlijk breder dan alleen maar Kamerleden voor die commissie. Klopt dat?
Als in de zin van hey, de Kamerleden. Maar je wilt uiteindelijk dus dat gesprek natuurlijk ook breder hebben. Hè? Dat wil je ook uiteindelijk met staatsrechtgeleerden wil je dat voeren. Om te zorgen dat, ja, dat het niet ook weer naar binnen gekeerd.
Ja, je zou bijvoorbeeld de commissie Remkes, die een mooi dik rapport heeft geschreven over de rol van het parlement, die zou je hier ook nog kunnen betrekken.
Ja, en ik denk dat daar meerdere bij betrokken kunnen worden.
Is het misschien niet, als ik even kijk naar hoe de Staten-Generaal in Nederland functioneert, dan niet voor de hand liggen dat je zegt, we maken dan een commissie van de Staten-Generaal, dus Eerste en Tweede Kamer, die dan bij wijze van spreken hoorzittingen organiseert of anderszins dus ja, mensen uitnodigt, staatsrechtgeleerden, eventueel dus ook Europese staatsrechtgeleerden, van wat kunnen we leren van het Verfassungsgericht in Karlsruhe, ja, wat kunnen we leren van een aantal dingen op dat punt in andere, ook Europese landen, om vervolgens dan als Staten-Generaal weer te zeggen, nou, uit die lessen trekken wij bijvoorbeeld deze belangrijke conclusies voor het functioneren van artikel 68.
Ja, nou, en in dat opzicht zou je ook nog op een andere manier naar kunnen kijken. Hè. De Venetië Commissie die wordt ingesteld. Hè. Daar heb ik in mijn bijdrage ook nog naar gerefereerd van wat daar nu de status van is. Want
ja, dat is een commissie die geleerd is aan de Raad van Europa. En die gaat eigenlijk een soort review maken van hoe de Nederlandse rechtsstaat functioneert en of burgers wel voldoende tot hun recht komen als er bijvoorbeeld een conflict is met overheden.
Ja, ja, en dus die kijken dus van buitenaf, kijken die naar hoe Nederland dat doet en hoe daarmee omgaat. En dat is een motie die is door Pieter Omtzigt al eerder ingediend.
Ja, hij heeft daar ook in Betrouwbare Bronnen uitgebreid over gesproken.
Kijk, nou, dan is de cirkel
zelfs de hele geschiedenis van de Venetië Commissie is behandeld, want ja, zo doen wij dat, hè, in deze podcast.
Ja, mooi. Maar dus dat is belangrijk. En daar is ook nog aanvullend daarop, is ook in dat debat, is een motie van het CDA is ook aangenomen, die hebben wij ook weer mee ondertekend en ingediend, over een constitutioneel hof. Juist om ook te zorgen dat er aan de grondwet getoetst kan worden, dat dat veel meer een levendig onderdeel wordt, ook van onze parlementaire democratie.
Ja, dan kom je ook weer trouwens bij het Bundesverfassungsgericht terecht. Wat trouwens ook wel eens ertoe leidt, dat Bundesverfassungsgericht, dat bepaalde Europese maatregelen vertraagd worden in hun uitvoering.
Ja, en dus zal daarin ook goed vanuit de Europese Unie en zal daar goed nagedacht moeten worden van hoe je dat dus goed kan inrichten. Dus ik zie dat niet per se als iets verkeerd, maar juist als een aanvulling over ook om te zorgen dat dat op een echte goede, doordachte manier geïmplementeerd wordt.
Nou, als je kijkt naar het totale pakket, dan is het duidelijk dat u als eerste ondertekenaar van die motie het presidium maar een beetje moet opporren dat die commissie van de Staten-Generaal er is voordat die Venetië-commissie naar Nederland komt. Want dan kunnen die twee commissies bij elkaar kruipen en misschien ook elkaar voeden met hun inzichten.
Nou, dat is een mooie suggestie.
Even nog iets wat mij ja, een beetje fascineert. Ik las in het verslag van Herman Cenk Willink. Die had eigenlijk ook een soort reprimande richting de Tweede Kamer. Dat vond ik wel spannend. Hij zegt, ja, de Tweede Kamer moet ook naar zichzelf kijken. Want vertrouwen en matiging hebben plaatsgemaakt voor wantrouwen en escalatie. Verantwoording vragen wordt vervangen door schuldigen zoeken. En van fouten leren wordt vervangen door afrekenen. Nou was meteen het eerste debat waar u aan deelnam. En waar u ook stemde voor een motie die eigenlijk een afrekenmotie was. Hè? Dat was een motie van wantrouwen die het net niet haalde tegen minister-president Rutte.
De eerste motie waar Volt voor stemde was een motie van de heer Wilders.
Nee, klopt. En dat is natuurlijk dat hebben we ook niet lichtzinnig genomen. En dat was voor ons ook een hectisch debat. Ik denk voor iedereen. En tijdens zo'n debat ga je op een gegeven moment nadenken van, en dat is ook de vraag die ik toen gesteld heb, van ja, in wat voor bestuurscultuur ben ik terechtgekomen en hoe wordt daarmee omgegaan? En gedurende zo'n debat ga je op een gegeven moment je afweging maken van, ga je inderdaad deze motie steunen? En is wat hier gepresenteerd wordt, is dat geloofwaardig? En is dat de manier waarop jij het idee hebt dat politiek zou moeten zijn en politiek bedreven zou moeten worden en hoe er dus met elkaar omgegaan wordt. En op dat moment was het antwoord nee. En dus vandaar dat we ook gezegd hebben, van, ja, die motie die steunen wij.
Ja, maar ik denk dat u het in het algemeen wel eens zal zijn met die opmerking van Cenk Willink van ja, afrekenen
en dat is ook de reden.
Zoeken, dat is eigenlijk niet wat waar het parlement
die term escalatie.
Nou, en dat is ook de reden hè, van dat we bij het afgelopen debat over de notulen, dat we op een gegeven moment hebben gezegd, ja oké, we hebben nu deze notulen opgevraagd. Dat is al vrij uitzonderlijk dat dat gebeurt. We gaan nu niet ook meteen de motie sturen of de verzoek steunen om alle notulen openbaar te maken. En we hebben ook daarin gezegd van oké, en we steunen ook niet de motie van wantrouwen, omdat dat uiteindelijk ook niet bij gaat dragen aan het oplossen van de problemen voor de toeslagenslachtoffers. En dat het uiteindelijk ook Nederland op dit moment niet beter maakt. Dus van daarin hebben we ook weer de afweging ook gemaakt van ja, oké, op een gegeven moment moeten we ook verder. En de regering is afgetreden over de toeslagenschandaal. En
betekent dit ook dat u straks om deze reden ook zou kunnen accepteren mocht Mark Rutte toch weer de premier worden?
Ik hoop dat Mark Rutte ook reflecteert op zijn eigen rol. En
dat heeft hij beloofd, dat hij zal doen.
Dus aankomend debat, ik kijk daar dus ook naar uit van wat die reflectie dan precies zal inhouden. Maar niet alleen van wat is zijn rol, niet alleen als persoon, maar ook als minister-president. En wat die rol betekent voor het vertrouwen van mensen in onze democratie. Niet alleen nu, maar ook voor de langere termijn. Niet alleen in Nederland, maar juist ook in Europa. En dus ik ben heel benieuwd naar aanstaande woensdag als we dat debat gaan voeren. En ik kijk daar verder ook naar uit, omdat dat ook wel weer een moment is dat we ook hopelijk weer vooruit gaan kijken de richting, zodat we uiteindelijk ook de problemen van mensen waar we uiteindelijk voor gekozen zijn, dat we die ook gaan aanpakken.
U heeft 3 zetels. Nou heeft NRC Handelsblad onlangs een onderzoek gedaan onder Kamerleden. En daar bleek uit dat eigenlijk de ervaring is dat je eigenlijk minimaal 11 zetels moet hebben om goed te kunnen functioneren in de Tweede Kamer. Nou heeft Damian net verteld dat hij bij de Groenen is gaan zitten om zo zijn werk effectiever te maken. Heeft u ook ideeën over samenwerking met andere fracties in de Tweede Kamer?
Ik heb het onderzoek zelf niet gezien. Dus ik weet niet precies wat dan onder het goed functioneren valt.
Met z'n drieën kun je natuurlijk niet.
Je kunt niet
alle ministers en staatssecretarissen goed controleren.
Dus daarin zul je ook keuzes moeten maken. En daarin zullen we ook heel duidelijk ook moeten communiceren richting onze kiezers ook van wat gaan we wel en wat kunnen we ook niet doen. En waar we het niet kunnen doen, zullen we inderdaad ook moeten kijken van oké, is er een partij die op dat onderwerp redelijk gelijk met ons opgaat of juist gelijk met ons opgaat, zodat die daar ons ook kan vertegenwoordigen. Dat zal af en toe moeten gebeuren. Want jij, met z'n drieën moet je af en toe een keuze maken.
Dus het hoeft niet vreemd te klinken als we straks af en toe horen in een commissievergadering door een Kamerlid van een andere partij. Ik spreek vandaag mede namens de fractie van Volk.
Nee, dat hoeft helemaal niet vreemd te klinken. En ik denk ook dat dat onderdeel moet zijn van het werk wat je samen in de Kamer doet. En wat een van de dingen die mij ook opvalt is van heel veel collega parlementariërs die zijn ook behulpzaam, denken ook mee. En uiteindelijk zit je daar namelijk niet alleen maar vanuit je eigen partij, maar je zit daar om mensen te vertegenwoordigen. En dat kan dus ook partijoverstijgend zijn. Kijk, wij zijn met Volt zijn we voor samenwerking in Europa. Maar natuurlijk niet alleen voor samenwerking in Europa, dat is ook voor samenwerking in Nederland. En ja, dus dat zou helemaal niet raar hoeven klinken.
Ja, aan de andere kant, ik zou bijna zeggen een soort opbeurende opmerking. Je ziet dat een SGP met 3 zetels in staat is ver boven zijn gewicht te opereren met keuzes, maar ook met de kwalitatieve inhoud. En je ziet bijvoorbeeld een man als Dion de Graus zit in een fractie van duidelijk meer dan 11 zetels.
Ja.
Dus zo zie je maar weer.
En ik bedoel, kijk, het is ook de inbreng die je dadelijk hebt. Hè? En we hebben het toen straks even over transparantie gehad. Van wat doet de Nederlandse regering in Brussel en in de Europese Unie. Nou, als wij daar een heel duidelijk continu vragen over stellen. En dat naar voren weten te brengen. Ja, dan kunnen wij hartstikke mooie bijdragen gaan leveren aan het debat in de Tweede Kamer. Dus ik zie ook met 3 mensen en zeker in deze tijd en daarnaast staat er een hele organisatie achter ons van actieve leden, van experts die ons graag meehelpen. Dus ik heb er alle vertrouwen in dat we daar ook de komende jaren profijt van gaan hebben.
Als u aan het eind van de parlementaire periode van 4 jaar, waar u met z'n 3 in zit, en ik ga er even vanuit dat u niet zoals veel andere nieuwe fracties prompt uit elkaar valt.
Geen afsplitsingen.
Ja. Alles kan in dit land. Als u aan het eind van die 4 jaar 1 ding hebt bereikt, dat u zegt, ik kan naar de kiezers van Volt van 17 maart 2021 in 2025 zeggen, jongens, we hebben een heleboel dingen niet kunnen doen met z'n 3, maar dit wel. Wat is dat?
Nou, dat is eigenlijk wat ik net aangaf. Dat is voor mij het allerbelangrijkste, is dat het debat over Europese samenwerking veranderd is. Dat je kunt zeggen, in Nederland is een opener debat. Het is veel duidelijker wat Nederland daarin doet. En dat daar ook veel meer in het Europese debat de Nederlandse inbreng wordt meegenomen. Ik denk, dat is misschien een wat abstract iets, maar ik geloof zeker dat als we dat voor elkaar weten te krijgen, dan is dat 1 goed voor Nederland en 2 goed voor Europa.
Dit is Betrouwbare Bronnen.
Bij ons is nog steeds Damian Beuzelager. We gaan hem er weer bij betrekken. Damian, are you both already coordinating any concrete actions you can do in the European Parliament and the Dutch Parliament together?
We are at the beginning of, defining a bit our cooperation, but we already have a lot of conversations and we see a lot of potential to do a lot together. Yeah? Be it on my work on the recovery fund, where obviously we just talked about it earlier, there is a lot of coordination possible, be it on the work on migration and asylum. Marieke Kukoc already took over and presented some of the ideas that we are working on the European level when it comes to voluntary solidarity. So the actual, power of municipalities to accept asylum seekers from the Greek borders, albeit when it comes to digital policy and the whole question of, how can we ensure that our startups work across the European continent? Or when it comes to also EU reform, I work on the Electoral Law Act right now and I will need support from the national level. And so I think to be able to work together on these topics will be extremely fruitful. And I'm super happy that we have such strong candidates now, or strong MPs now in the Tweede Kamer.
It would even be more effective for you in the European Parliament if Volt would be part of a Dutch national coalition and would have clear, let's say, cabinet power.
I will leave this question to Laurens.
No, but I believe that we also from a national from the national parliament can of course ensure that we strengthen also the topics that Damian is working on by asking questions, by ensuring that we send the government or the ministers with a certain mandate to Brussels to discuss it, but also on the other side to make transparent what have the Dutch ministers discussed in Brussels and what has come out, and to tell also the story to the Dutch people of how the Netherlands is cooperating in Brussels. And I think this is very important because this is something that is completely lacking at the moment.
This is a very interesting point. I have always been surprised that, for instance, the Dutch Education Committee in Parliament never asks the Minister of Education when she or he comes back from important negotiations on, for instance, Horizon or Erasmus, what have you done in Brussels? What will this mean for the Dutch HBO, for the Dutch universities, for the Dutch professional education?
Exactly. This should also be more part of the debate within the Dutch parliament. And I believe, but Damian, maybe you can help me, is that this is more done in Germany or in France or in other countries. This is far more part of the debate within the parliament itself, but also part of the debate within society. And that is something that where we in the Netherlands are still lacking. And I believe that also our ambition within the Netherlands itself and our contribution to Europe can be far more improved to also have, to have the debate of what Europe we want to have, if we also start to have the debate this in the national parliament as well. And indeed, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's strange that this is never discussed.
It's always before the European summit, Mr. Rutte, you know, gets a lot of homework from Dutch parliament, most of it very irrelevant national sort of topics of the day. And then when he comes back, nothing happens.
Yeah. But it's not only the prime minister, it's also the other ministers that go to Brussels.
I mentioned the education minister, exactly. For which vast amounts of investment in R&D, in knowledge, etc., comes from Europe, thank God. But the national minister is never asked, what have you done? What have you discussed with your colleagues? Have you maybe cooperated with the Baltic ministers who are much ahead on digitalization, for instance?
And what have you learned and what can be improved? And
exactly.
I mean, I had moments when I was negotiating or part of the negotiating team for the budget, I think it was back then 2022, so a yearly budget. And we were in negotiations with the different member states. And at the same time in Germany, Merkel went on the stage and said, we need to invest more in Europe on education, while her negotiating team was actually saying the exact opposite in the negotiations. And there's this lack of transparency. And I think we really need to solve this. And I think all our debates are currently too national. Yeah, I don't know if you have to check me on this, but I think that around 40% of our legislation now come from the European level already. But nobody knows this. And the national politicians have no interest at all in accepting this, apart from, you know, our little European party, because we don't lose from it. We don't have an issue. We don't give power away. We keep it within the European party. And I think that's another reason why we definitely need European parties.
Don't forget that from that legislation that is coming also to the Netherlands, the Netherlands was part of the development. And that's also something that
European
is often...
legislation is national legislation. Exactly. Because it's the nations who say so. And of course, very often, politicians at national level then says, yes, we are forced to do this by Brussels. But Brussels are they themselves.
For the negative parts, yes, they will say Brussels did this, even though it was them. For the positive side, they will never say it was European. They just say, oh, we have this great idea. You know, and that's actually an issue.
Jacques Delors once said to me, look at those press conferences afterwards. All those leaders then come to their national journalists and they scream, j'ai gagné, j'ai gagné. And he was then in his late 80s and he was furious because he hated this. Exactly what you say is was my victory. And the things they don't like to say, yes, I was forced to do this by Brussels.
Damian, your grandfather was Philip von Boeselager. He died in 2008. He was 25 years of age when he was a member of the 20 July 1944 plot, the conspiracy of the Wehrmacht officers to assassinate Adolf Hitler. Did you talk with him about this very important moment in history?
Yeah, a lot. I have to say I went with him on many of his speeches. He talked a lot in schools and he often needed someone to go with him. So I went many times. I think it's definitely an important part of my upbringing. But also I have to say that, sometimes it's important to understand that individuals take choices. And I don't know, I think he took the right choice, yeah. But I don't know what kind of choice I would have taken. So I think we always have to ask ourselves, what can we do right now in our moments where we are to make the right choice and not necessarily think that, only because our grandfather did the wrong choice or the right choice that this, will direct our choices as well. Yeah? We are free to do what we want to do.
Was your grandfather one of those young sort of aristocratic officers who made this plot to blow up the Führer? Because not many young people in Holland maybe know that.
Yeah, so they had like I think three attempts to assassinate Hitler. And I mean, one is the more famous one of the 20th of July, where Stauffenberg planted like some explosives and then blew up some part of the Führer's group, if you like, leading committee. I don't know what you call it. But there were some like two smaller ones where they failed all in the last moment. After the 20th of July, I think the group was either killed or tortured. So after that, it was a bit done. But before, there were two tries before, but also from other sides, as you know. Yeah.
How did he survive?
He always carried around Tsionkali in his breast pocket because he thought that they would find him out. His brother, very likely after the 20th of July, killed himself by going into the enemy lines. The reason why he wasn't found out is because a man called Schlabendorf, under torture, didn't give out my grandfather's name. So that's why he was never found. But all his people that he talked to, Tresco was, for example, his mentor, they all either killed themselves or were killed by the Nazi.
An unbelievable story. An unbelievable life also.
It's. I think sometimes it's interesting to think how young they all were. You know, like these officers with 25, that's really young. But I mean, again, I think what I at least for myself take from it is, I think he took a difficult decision at the right time because he also had people helping him understand what was going on, and he always said that. Yeah, without, for example, this Tresco officer, he would have never had the courage to go this way. And so I think to understand that we can help each other take the right decisions is important.
And it's also a very important story for us in the Netherlands in this week, in which we remember the Second World War and everything what went wrong in those years. It must be inspiring for you, I think, on a daily basis, Damian.
Yeah, but on the other hand, I avoid actually talking about this too much because I think what is a wrong conception is that somehow, because he took the right decision, I would take the right decision. Yeah? I think this link is not there. You can only say this is inspiring for me and this is something I adhere to or I think about. But in the end, everyone has the same kind of, you know, freedom to make the right decisions. And I'm sorry if I'm repeating this point, but I think it's quite important to, you know, not gloat about, your forefathers or also, you know, take the, it might also be, you know, negative things that they bring. Yeah.
We come to a conclusion of this talk. There is one member in the European Parliament of VOLT. There are three now in the Dutch Parliament. There are also about 30 local politicians, for example, in Frankfurt, in Bonn, in Köln, in München, in Rome. What are the next EU member states you aim on to get seats in the national parliament?
Well, the next one is Germany, I believe. So in September.
Are the polls at the moment for VOLT in Germany?
So I think we're still a bit below the poll level, I have to say. I mean, we will run for the Berlin elections and the national elections in September, for sure. And yeah, we will try to give our best to make a strong result there. But also in the other countries, there are always elections coming up. That's a good thing. If you're a European party, there will always be elections that you're trying to run for. And we are trying to build, all across the continent, a strong, positive pro-European force.
Yeah, so Lisbon, Copenhagen, Milan, I believe, are also this year. It's a continuous campaign throughout Europe.
There's a world to win. Thank you very much, Damian and Laurens, for this very nice, informative talk.
Thank you very much.
That's nice to do it for the first time together. Cheers, Damian.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Zo, dit was Betrouwbare Bronnen, aflevering 189. Deze aflevering is mede mogelijk gemaakt door de Europese Unie en door de vrienden van de show. Een donatie is zeer welkom. Dat kan via vriendvandeshow.nl/bb. Adverteren kan trouwens ook. Meer informatie daarover vind je in de beschrijving van deze aflevering. Dinsdag zijn we weer en dan gaan we het hebben over Napoleon Bonaparte. Tot dan.
Betrouwbare Bronnen wordt gemaakt door Jaap Jansen in samenwerking met dag-en-nacht.nl.